This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about abusive relationships and the law. I'm joined by barrister, senior barrister, Mr. John Riley from 23 Essex Street Chambers in London. John specialises in serious sexual, violent crime and drug-related cases, and he's an expert and leader in this field. His expertise in these areas has led to him representing the Criminal Bar Association for many years on shaping policy and legislative direction of the new demands of complex cases in these challenging areas of law. He regularly writes and speaks on the areas of expertise, and he has been acknowledged in a number of leading publications and works on sexual offences. John is also an elected councillor in a London borough. Thank you very much for joining us, John.
Not at all. Nice to be seeing you again.
Absolutely. It's a delight to record with you, John, even if I must say so myself.
Thank you.
So our topic today, abusive relationships, part one. A very interesting subject. And I think that the way that we're going to be discussing this area of law and this topic actually is going to be super interesting, because I was only just saying to you, wasn't I, before we press record, that some of the questions that we've got here to be discussed are actually questions that I myself, as a layperson, would ask about this area of law. So let's start with what I thought was one of the most obvious thing to ask, because when we discuss this topic. And that is, why are we using the title abusive relationships and not, for example, domestic violence, domestic abuse, which is how it possibly is more commonly known in the profession?
Well, Hattie, I've been dealing with these sorts of cases for quite a long time. And for a long time, I've preferred the title abusive relationships. Myself and a co-author, Laura Hyanu from Wadham College, Oxford, have been doing quite a bit of writing on these types of relationships, and we concluded that abusive relationships was a much more accurate title for what actually happens. I think domestic violence, although it is the title of the new act or the new bill rather going through Parliament, and it's a commonly understood term, is for me, it's almost too cozy a title. It has connotations of it all about being about in the house or in some way lesser than other types of violence. So because there is a range of different activity that can affect a victim of abusive relationships, we have chosen to champion that term because we just think it's more accurate. It covers certainly a lot of the new activities and behaviours under the coercive and controlling behaviour legislation, and we just prefer it as a title. We're trying to get people to change the way they refer to what happens in these circumstances to become abusive relationships, and certainly in the cases that I have prosecuted, I've used that term, and judges seem to like it, and indeed lay people, the victims and others, and the police seem to like it.
And you know what, I have to say that completely resonates with me, because I also think that, and again I know I've said this to you in an earlier conversation, that over the years where you, on the very odd occasion, thankfully, you've heard somebody say, oh, that person's in an abusive relationship, we don't actually, I think, as lay people, say, oh, that person suffers from domestic violence or domestic abuse as a lay person. It's more referred to by the everyday person as an abusive relationship. So that's why I could really resonate with what you're saying. And let's talk about an abusive relationship. What do we mean by an abusive relationship? What is an abusive relationship?
Well, there is a statutory definition or a government definition that it's any incident or pattern of incidents of controlling, coercive or threatening behaviour, violence or abuse between those aged 16 or over, or who are intimate partners or family members, regardless of gender and sexuality.
That's interesting, isn't it? 16 yeah. or over, because automatically I would have thought, for some reason, 18 and over.
Well, 16 or under is the falls into the category of child abuse. So there's plenty of law that deals with under 16. So the rationale for that age determination, and you're right, of course, mostly 18 in the criminal law is defined as the age at which a person ceases to be a child and becomes an adult. So therefore, anybody under 18 technically is a child. Of course, you've then got the anomaly between 16 and 18 concerning certain consents and capacities. You can marry at 16, and other entitlements kick in at 16, but you've still got 18 as the age of majority. But that's what the government have gone for, because under 16, there is plenty of law to cater for people, for children, essentially, and how they get dealt with. But it also includes psychological, physical, sexual, financial, emotional and behavioural behaviour, which sounds a bit odd, but I can come back to that later, in terms of what the abuser does to the abused person.
Well, I've always said that abuse comes in various forms. And again, another sort of stereotypical idea that maybe we can be guilty of having as Joe Public is that an abusive relationship means that somebody is hit. You're hit. But I actually think that some of the most shocking forms of abuse that I've certainly seen have been mental abuse over the physical abuse.
Yeah, it's far more, I think, harmful, damaging, insidious and mean. The other forms of coercive control behaviour, various descriptions are given for that under the Serious Crimes Act of 2015. It actually makes coercive control a specific criminal offence. And it refers to things like threats, yes, assaults, yes, but then goes on to talk about humiliation, intimidation.
Very interesting. You'd never, ever think, I have to say, humiliation would have been come under that kind of title. I wouldn't have imagined it. I wouldn't have even thought it would.
Well, when you think about it, people who are abusers who want to take over the life of the abused person, and that's very often what this is all about. It's control. It's having a very certain control over somebody. How do they do it? They don't just do it. Rarely, in my experience, does it happen immediately as a sudden flash. It's done over a period of time. It's done in a very gradual and insidious way. So it might in the first instance, and often does. You'll hear this from victims in cases. Certainly in criminal cases, they'll say, well, you know, I thought he was looking after, it's usually men and women, I thought he was looking after me. I thought he was being good to me by saying, I'll take care of all the money. I'll take care of all the bills. I'll take care of everything. You don't have to worry. Because then it develops, and we've seen this time and time again, into quizzing the abuse.
Where have you spent that? Why did you go? Why? What's on that bill? What's on that bank statement? And then before you know it, that person can't go and spend anything on anything that they wish to because they have to get permission.
That's exactly right.
To do so.
That's exactly right. And, you know, who are you seeing? The typical example is where the abuser will say, right, you know, when she comes home, he'll say, give me your phone. I want to go through your phone and see who you've been talking to or see who you've been contacting.
Hold on a minute. I've said that to my husband. Am I falling into a dangerous category here, John?
I don't know, but certainly
I haven't said that actually.
No. But certainly that is that's interesting. You should ask that, you see, because what worried me very early on about these sorts of cases is that there's a generational and plus generational issue here that certainly my parents and my grandparents very certainly had very specific roles in their marriage. And in those days, you know, the male would do certain things and would assume certain roles in terms of the household, which was perfectly acceptable in those days and perfectly unexpected in many ways. So you very often would hear about ladies who may have lost their husbands or got divorced very late in life of a certain age, who would have not had the experience of essentially looking after themselves in terms of the business
financially,
of,
probably
of the house
first and
or
foremost,
whatever, because the husband had always done it. Now that was, you know, that was not coercive control. That was just the way people set themselves up.
Yes.
But what's interesting is that these days, even though there will be relationships that still work on that very traditional pattern, some abusers will use that formula as a basis for then becoming abusive and coercive and controlling. And we see it time and time again. Restriction on who you see. You only need me to be with you. You know,
why do you need to go to lunch with that person or this person, or why do you need to go out in the evening?
All of that.
And obviously the control is because if somebody's controlling you financially, you can't physically go out and do anything because you won't have the money to. They're controlling how you spend it or where you spend it.
That's right. And it may well then move on to not necessarily physical abuse, but certainly threats, possibly in relation to children, possibly in relation to other family members and so forth. So it's in terms of we've looked at this, haven't we, in terms of recognition and awareness. And I think in terms of noticing if it's possible for the abused person, because very often part and parcel of the abuse is making that experience feel normal. The capacity to notice that this is not normal, that this is not a caring person, that this is not somebody who is just merely caring for them. It is controlling. And I think if people who are potentially being abused do understand that what's happening to them is going far beyond what they might otherwise expect. And the problem, of course, is, Hattie, that this is all very often set against a background of love.
I was going to say, you know, because it must be difficult. And I'm sure you've seen plenty of cases, John, where the person, the victim, is saying, but he loves me. He might do that, but he loves me.
Yeah.
You know, and therefore it kind of makes it okay. And it's almost an immediate forgiving position. And that can be probably, I should imagine, that becomes then very hard for any victim to actually stand up and recognize that they are actually in an abusive relationship and not in a caring and loving relationship. Or, you know,
one way to deal with that, possibly, and I understand this is very, very difficult, and of course I'm coming at it from the sort of even sharper end when we're dealing with criminal cases. But it seems to me from that experience that one of the ways of dealing with that is to talk to your friends and family. Now, all right, you may want to give what they say a bit of a pinch of salt, maybe, because some of it may have to do with whether they like your partner or husband or whatever it is. But we've found very often that the first people to spot that there's something wrong is not the abused person at all, because they're too close and they're the ones who are having this behavior imposed upon. It's friends and family. And I remember one particular case where the close family said, you know, this family member of ours, she went from being a really strong, confident woman to being...
This is the thing. I've heard that in life myself as well. I absolutely have. And I have to say, it sends a shiver down my spine, because I have seen, actually, in our distant family, a member, a person, a lady, who became a nothing, just crumbled and became a non-existent, nervous, unhappy person. And the saddest thing, John, is that she could never see it.
No, that's right.
She really couldn't. You're talking 30-odd years later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the other thing. It does last a very long time often. The cases I've dealt with have taken, may have taken months to build up. They might have taken years. Some of them, there have been reports from abused people in the Times in the recent past where they've talked about relationships of between 6 and 10 years that this has been going on. And it was only towards the very end that any physical violence was used, because she started, in one particular account, the lady explained she started to react against it all because she could see how things were going. So so it's not always the case that abusive relationships are punctuated by violence. That is, those will be the headline cases, if you like, and they will be the the common expectation cases. But actually, I do feel it's at least on par sometimes with the physical violence, the destruction of someone's confidence, the destruction of who they are as a person. And the worst thing is that having invested, very often as it is, as the woman in the relationship, having invested a very significant degree of emotion and love and commitment to what they believed was going to be a long-term relationship,
and they might still believe this is good, we've got issues, you know, I've heard these things, I really have. Every couple goes through problems, there's no such thing as a perfect couple. But then into that mix, and I say this as somebody who comes from a minority background culturally, the culture can have such a big impact on these things, because in certain cultures, and certainly in mine, it's very, very, very accepted and common that man runs the roost. If man says, well, not in my household, John, I'll just make that very clear. But if a man says, do you know what? I hold the purse strings. You'll ask me where you're going and how you're going. And, you know, that's how it is culturally. That happens in a lot of cultures.
Well, that's right. And it's difficult because where you do have, I mean, that's a whole different area of consideration, because where you do have a cultural way of dealing with things, it might be accepted, and it might be taken for that's how we do it. The question is, when do you get to a point where that becomes extreme and it becomes abusive rather than the accepted norm? And one of the difficulties that certainly the prosecution will have, I think, as we go forward with this and as awareness becomes greater and reporting becomes greater, is, in a sense, separating out what might otherwise have been accepted, but by the proposed or supposed abusive person, in those particular circumstances, because one of the tools that the abuser will use in those cultural situations is essentially to say, well, if you don't do what you're told, you'll end up being ostracized by your community.
If your parents or if your brother or your sister or found out, or if my parent, you know, you'll be disgraced in society for even thinking like that. And then the whole Westerner attitude can come into it, perhaps, in some cases, you know. But having said that, I mean, my view certainly is that even if it's culturally acceptable, because, you know, as I said, I come from a minority background, and a lot of things in my culture are not acceptable to me. Yeah. It doesn't make it right. It could still come under the banner of an abusive relationship.
Yeah.
Even if your entire cultural background says, well, that's how it is. That's how we do things in this culture. You're part of this culture. You have the right, as somebody in the UK, living in the UK, in the rules that govern this country, to stand up and say, well, do you know what? I don't find that acceptable. I find that abusive.
Yeah. I think that's a very complicated area, but in one sense, it's very simple. If a person comes forward, that's the point. If a person comes forward and says, this is what is happening to me and I want something done about it, then the authorities, the police and the prosecution have the opportunity to do something. in non-cultural situations, let's say, that we've been talking about previously, that you're absolutely, the main difficulty is the willingness of the abused person to maintain their complaint.
And you've mentioned this to me before in our last podcast. I remember we discussed this. I can't remember if it was part of the podcast or it was a conversation me and you were having before and after, but one of the problems is that somebody will come forward and make the complaint and then they will want to withdraw it for various reasons, we were saying, weren't we?
Yeah, and maybe in a later a discussion we can go into this in more detail, but certainly it is a very common experience for the prosecuting authorities, the police, and for the caring agencies to have to grapple with the fact that part and parcel of the behaviour of some complainants in these circumstances is that they will make a complaint, then retract, make a complaint, then retract, and it will go on like that. And that's that. Ironically, what we've been able to do is to explain what we call that as being a counterintuitive behaviour, as being part and parcel of the abuse, because because the mindset of somebody who has been so overborne or subordinated according to the legislation, in other words, really ground down, frankly, it is to try and fight back and then withdraw, and try and fight back and then withdraw. And we need to understand that that is part of the symptoms of an abused person or an abused.
And I think that's a really important message, John, because the message that I'm hearing as you're saying that, actually, what's coming into my mind very clearly is, you know, don't let any abuser tell you no one's going to believe you, because you've already told them that you're withdrawing a complaint once or twice or three times. Don't, you know, what you're saying is that actually is very common as a pattern and as a way of thing, how things roll out in sometimes in these situations, where it could be the abuser's persuading you to withdraw and you're thinking, oh no, but he does love me and he has done that. Or she, you know, the abuser could be a she, and you could be thinking, well, you know, she really does want this relationship and it was a mistake and she won't do it again. And then there's on and on of the reasons why a victim can stand up and say, oh no, I don't want this to proceed. I don't want any criminal proceedings against my partner. I want to withdraw this. You know, perhaps it's a part of that person wishing that things could be normal, could be more normal and without the abuse. There's various reasons. But the message that you're sending there loud and clear is, don't let that put you off as a victim and coming and make a complaint, even if, no matter how many times you've withdrawn your complaint originally or a different complaint, actually, because this is common behaviour and it's seen.
It is. And
often.
I think it's, I think it is important that people understand that there are common but unexpected, or as we call it, counterintuitive behaviours. So the absolute outstandingly stark one that almost everybody says is why, and I know I'm saying he and she, but my experience or the experience of the courts is, or of the criminal justice system, tends to be that it is men abusing women, but I understand it can be anybody, obviously. But the absolute outstanding one is always, why don't you leave? Why didn't you leave? Well, most of the complainants that I've ever dealt with have said, well, where do I go? I've built a house with this man. Well, not built. I've built a home with this man. We may have bought the house together or the flat or whatever it is. I've put myself in a position which, you know, I was hoping would be a normal one, and looking forward to a nice relationship and all the rest of it. Very few people in reality could think to themselves at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning when they've just had enough and they're at their absolute wit's end, or they've been beaten or whatever it is, okay, I'm going now and I've got somewhere to go to.
Well, added to that, what if there are children in the relationship? Well, that's where it's not so easy to say to people, why don't you just get up and go? I mean, it's easy for us to say it, but in practice, as you put it, you know, we culturally, society, in my opinion, we don't live in a society where you can just knock on your neighbour's door and get in there. It's not, I don't feel like we live in such a close-knit society as maybe it was when I was growing up, and there was that you could feel the bond between the neighbours and between family friends that, you know, even if your family didn't live close by, there were family friends that your parents were close with and you knew that they were part of your sort of community. A lot of that in most places, I think, you know, has gone. And if you're a victim where your family or his family or her family don't actually agree that with you or, you know, see your behaviour as outrageous because you're calling somebody, you know, abusive or saying that they are, that adds to the complication. But we're going to discuss this last point because it's so key and it's linking up to what we're saying. And if there are children, matters can become very complicated, far more difficult than I would like to imagine as somebody who's not been in that position. But are there differences between abusive relationships for those with children and those without children? I mean, headline points.
Well, I think there are, because and they are very different. Sometimes children are used by the abusive partner against the abused partner. So again, in this insidious way, isn't mummy clumsy? Isn't mummy stupid? Isn't mummy silly? Hasn't she done this wrong? Hasn't she done that wrong? And they always get, unwittingly, they get the children on their side because the kids don't know any different. They just think it's a game. So there's that kind of aspect where the children are otherwise not abused themselves, absolutely not, but they are used within the relationship, again, usually against the woman. There are other circumstances, obviously, where the children themselves are the victims of normally physical abuse. But the other problem is, of course, the children witnessing that whole atmosphere and the way things go. And very often we've had cases where children have had statements taken from them or undergone interviews, not necessarily to use them in the proceedings, but just to get a better picture as to what's been going on. And they'll talk about mummy spending the whole time crying, or they see that she's got bruises and all this sort of thing. And the whole area, I know Jess Phillips MP spent a great deal of time on this in the new bill, domestic violence bill in the House of Commons, dealing with amendments to that bill that dealt with how we respond to support for children from abusive relationships. It doesn't mean to say the children themselves have been abused. In a sense, it means they have become abused because they're living in that sort of relationship.
It's toxic. It's utterly toxic, isn't it? Yeah. That a child is in an environment where they're witnessing any sort of abuse, whether it's mental abuse or physical abuse. They're both as bad as each other. There isn't one, I think, that anyone would openly say is worse than the other. But for a child to be in that environment, it's an abuse to them, isn't it? For them to be allowed to be in that environment.
And the other slightly unfortunate, well, it's more than that, risk, is that experience suggests that when such relationships become more public, in terms of perhaps social services being told or caring agencies being told, because the imperative, and you'll know this from your area of law, because the imperative is the best interests of the child, very often the complainant, the abused woman, the mother and wife or partner, whatever, will find herself almost being blamed for allowing her children to be exposed to, as you put it, a toxic and abusive relationship. And that, I think, that also weighs incredibly heavily and emotionally awfully with an abused woman. And I'm sure
we see it, John, in the family cases that we run. If we're acting for the woman and the man's trying to sort of get more time with the children or trying to paint a bad picture of the woman in divorce proceedings relating to the finances, which have got, they're completely separate. But so many times I have seen in witness statements how a woman is a bad mother because she shouted in front of them, or she's allowed them to be in the room when the shouting is going on, or, you know, other elements of pleasantries that have taken place. And I've seen people use that against each other in divorce proceedings, and it's really sad. And I tell you, I don't allow clients to do it. Absolutely not. Children are a completely separate issue to your finances of your marriage and your divorce. And, you know, we make that very, very clear. But you're spot on. And that must be a difficult crossover. Absolutely.
It is. And I've had cases where, for example, the complainant will say, well, do you know what? I keep the children out really, really late. You know, we'll walk around the park till it's dark or whatever, so that they're tired, so I can put them straight to bed so they don't have to witness what's going on. But you can't do that all the time. And that side of things needs to be acknowledged. And as I say, Jess Phillips has done a lot of work in the house on raising that as an area of concern that ought to be recognised in terms of support and feeding into what it means to be an abusive relationship.
John, I tell you, another fascinating and very interesting podcast with a whole host. I can see a part 24 to this. We haven't even got into your book yet. There you go.
It's an extraordinary area, and it's one that needs wide attention and recognition and understanding. That's for certain.
Well, I can assure you of this. Get Legally Speaking will be creating as much attention and as much understanding to it as we possibly can. But on this podcast, I'll say thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much for your expertise and your insights.
You're very welcome.
And what I'll say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you very much for listening.
Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Our episodes are free to access. However, if you feel that you would like to support the children's charity that we are raising money for, then head over to our Just Giving page at justgiving.com and search for Hattie Savari, where we are raising money for orphaned children at SOS Children's Villages, one of the worthiest children's charities. Donate as little as £1 for a great cause. Thank you. Empower yourself today and follow us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. With over 3 million downloads and counting, do not miss out on learning more about a topic that interests you. Go over to our website at getlegallyspeaking.com and browse over 100 podcast episodes.